Blog Talk Radio.
It is Sunday, March 6, 2016, 6:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time in America. My name is Granton Taylor Hughes for my show, The Granton Taylor Hughes Show, with my guest host each week, Gabriella Foster. Hi, Gabriella. How are you? Are you there?
Yes, I am right here. I'm doing quite well. How about yourself, Grantham?
I'm doing fine, but I got out of the studio, so I hope that people are online with this. I'm not sure, because I accidentally hit the wrong key. So I think we're on, pretty sure.
Okay. I hope so.
Because now I have the studio screen up. And therefore, we have our editorial technical difficulties each week, and I do apologize, as I do pretty much every week, to the studio audience and to the audience that are a listening audience, I'll say, listening audience. All right. This week I'm going to talk about, oh, and how are you, by the way? Did I say that already?
Yes, you did. We already went through that.
Went through the amenities and
yes,
all
we did.
The kind things and fiddly things that
mm-hmm.
we do here.
That's true.
We do socially, so to speak. All right, this week I want to talk about the Sestucove Act of 1666, or it's really a trust that they use in the courtrooms, and they make a big deal out of it. But as I've said, because we know the Uniform Commercial Code that trumps the trust, they try to teach this complex scenario in the courtrooms so that they can cancel the trust. And I'm saying just forget about all that, because if you say three little letters, UCC, which represents Uniform Commercial Code, then it really just trumps the whole thing. So it's not an issue. People don't have to study that particular act. And because what it did is declared people dead because of all the plagues and everything that was going on in the Middle Ages. And it was really just an excuse to, in terms of the non-sovereign, that people are born or ordained sovereign, as I've often said on the show. And by this birth sovereignty, in a contracts law society, it needs to be enacted, documented, enacted, because we are dealing with paper contracts. All right? And that means that if we're born into this and there's no record of birth other than a birth certificate, which is a birth license, a license of birth for revenue purposes of the government, but in reference to it being a proof of sovereignty or gaining sovereignty, it's not proof. Like I was talking about last week, the issues with sovereignty and people claiming ordained sovereignty or just sovereignty. They're not even claiming ordained sovereignty because they don't make a distinction between enacted sovereignty and ordained sovereignty. Most people don't know that. They've heard this word sovereignty and they bandy it around. So when they throw it at the court system or the government, then they're put down with that whole thing because they're trying to get some kind of rights and all that business by the usage of sovereignty and getting in that position of sort of a rebellion type thing. So then they get into all kinds of trouble because of that. Mainly they have no knowledge, and then they end up having all those kinds of issues. But the courts will recognize enacted sovereignty because they know that the UCC is created by pure trust, but you can't get into that in terms of the discussion in the courtroom, so the technicality of the UCC is enough because the judges are aware of 1-308, which has the defendant aware of the law, and then that's the remedy in law is 1-308. So the remedy of Section 10 of the Uniform Commercial Code is the remedy of 1-308 that is stating to the court that the defendant is aware of the law and actually can have the case dismissed by the mere technicality of the UCC. Essentially, if they put that forward, that shows that they're not liable for the compelled benefit of the courtroom, because it is a necessity compelled benefit, in order for the usage of a venue, I'll say, just like money is a compelled benefit, anything really that's manifest that we need to use for empirical proof, or just like automobiles are a compelled benefit, everything is pretty much a compelled benefit because it compels us to act physically. So the court is aware of the fact that when people state 1-308, that now they're on the spot because defendant, whether they actually know it or not, when they cite that particular remedy, they're in a position of having the case dismissed because they don't want to record UCC or the statement in a courtroom. But a lot of times we found that they're removing recorders and you can't go in and record things. So they try to get around it as much as possible. But I'm always trying to tell people that UCC is a silver bullet if we utilize it and keep at it, keep on task with it, even if they're in denial of it or if they dishonor your position in Uniform Commercial Code, that you can dishonor there and they dishonor you. They go back and forth in the whole thing. But you have to stay on task or stay on point, whatever you want to call it. You have to stay in that position to keep defending yourself with the UCC because that's the law that they recognize. And eventually, as a sovereign, even an ordained sovereign, can utilize UCC and get their cases dismissed. In other words, they can put down any challenge with it if they remain on task. So that's some extensive information. Did you want to comment at that point? As the host is now needing feedback.
Yes. Right. No, I know. I mean, I know of a few people that have used UCC and been able to, if not win their cases, at least get them dismissed. So,
correct.
So
well, you can't win a case.
Right. Right. So they've had cases dismissed because the court doesn't want to go into and acknowledge UCC, but they just go ahead and find some other grounds to dismiss the case, as you were saying. So.
Well,
I do know that.
In one sense of the word, it is a win because you're getting the challenge put down by dismissal. But in terms of actual what they would say, acquitting or winning or whatever the case, they can't state it that way because then it would have to be recorded in their precedent law issues of winning the case. That means that when you dismiss cases, those are not recorded. They're as if they don't exist. Dismissal means that essentially it doesn't exist by law.
Right.
The way the legal language is, and that means that they're not recorded in the tan books, what I call the yellow books, facetiously. But they are dismissed cases, and they're not filed at court reporters or pathonitaries, as they're called, in America. And they're put in different files. They're not court record. So you can't use them as references in terms of case studies or college students or graduate students in law. They can't use it as reference material. So you cannot find those cases. And the reason for that is they don't want people to find out about the bankruptcy. Albeit it does exist, that bankruptcy is very real, but they're concerned about not allowing the awareness since 1930, the Geneva Convention. It's a huge embarrassment when you're talking about 86 years of a bankruptcy that hasn't been at large in the media. So now all of a sudden you're talking about it, that's a huge embarrassment and cause for revolution, really, government. So they're really concerned about it lingering for so long, and they really don't want to tell the public. So shows like mine who reveal information regarding it are done pretty much on a private basis. Not too many people listen in, and that's okay. But the handful that do become aware of it, you're entitled to the awareness that we provide on this show. At large, in terms of the legal issues of the remedy at UCC, it's very rare that appears in courtrooms. And so, therefore, it won't necessarily ever become a majority situation. It could, but then again, we address it at that time regarding it. And that means that, but since we're dealing with the bankruptcy, and in my opinion, it would, to become solvent, it would force the bankers to do, as I say, the approximate mathematics of not necessarily getting a perfect equilibrium, banking equilibrium, but it'd be approximate. It wouldn't be exact in terms of the measurement of every penny, because we can't do that. It doesn't work empirically. In terms, I've talked about that many times in terms of math being precise theoretically, but not precise empirically. And when you go to measure, that's why I've often said in terms of the GAAP stamp, they stamp on the pro formas and analyzing bookkeeping and accounting, and they'll put the accounting companies will put the GAAP stamp, which is called the General Accepted Accounting Principles stamp, GAAP, and then they'll put a stamp on the back of some of the larger firms. I think it's the Big Four now. It used to be the Big Eight about 20 years ago, but now it's, so this GAAP stamp declares that the numbers are accurate, and that if any other accounting firm, a lesser accounting firm, comes in and tries to measure and their numbers are different, then with the GAAP stamp, trumping any numbers that would come after thereafter. So that is the showing that mathematics is not really precise. It's just a declaration or a dictatorship by some accounting firm. It's kind of interesting, wouldn't you say?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and you've talked a lot about mathematics not being precise, so it's an interesting subject, because most people do think that it has to be exact.
Yes, yeah, so the banking issues are, it has to be measured down to the penny. That's why they exploit the bank drafts, because they're so expensive now when your banking account is not balancing. See, so that becomes a huge issue, and they make they exploit the market because of it, and bank overdrafts, the cost of overdrafts. And they're pretty outrageous now. Do you know what they are now, overdraft costs? I don't even know.
I don't know. Fortunately, I haven't had one in a very, very long time, so I have no idea what they charge.
Aren't they like $40 or $50 now or something? I don't know.
But I think that, you know, because people aren't writing as many checks, a lot of people are using debit cards these days. They don't charge you for being overdrawn on a debit card account. I know that. So, but they only overcharge you when it's a check. So not too many people write that many checks anymore. So, you know, I don't know. I myself don't write very many checks. So.
Right. So. But again, we're in a bankruptcy, and the proof of the money shows the Federal Reserve note, and that's a debt instrument, and it has been ever since 1930 when they started issuing that into the marketplace. And then they actually were calling in the silver certificates, and now the silver certificates are not money any longer. They're a commodity that's traded in numismatics, it's money trading. And money buying and selling, like fleticism of the stamp collecting. It's like collector's items now, the silver certificates. But they're not really used as a medium of exchange any longer. That's why we have the Federal Reserve notes that we use, but they're debt instruments. They're not credit instruments, and because they're not redeemable, and you cannot. That's why the banks, I've often said in the past, the banks are in breach of contract, because you can't redeem a certificate for the note. In other words, you can't turn that note back in and get a certificate to cover the note. See, so they're in breach of contract, and they don't really understand that per se. So if you took a Federal Reserve note to the bank and said, I'd like my certificate for this, my credit certificate, they wouldn't have any idea what you're talking about, and they don't have them. But essentially, you could sue every bank on earth right now, but I'm not recommending that. You could, but I don't recommend it, because then you're getting a provocative position with the banking that pretty much runs everything in reference to the money issues. See, so, mm-hmm. But they are in that position, and I reveal that on this show. I'm probably the only one that really understands that, because they're in breach of contract. But if you attempted to do that, now you really should know what you're talking about if you're going to sue a bank, basically. But somebody could pretty much take over a bank. Are you there? I'm hearing some kind of clicking noise. Are you there?
Yes, I'm sorry. I thought we were disconnected. I heard some dead space, okay, we're fine. We're connected.
Okay.
I thought I'd lost connection.
I heard something like a horse and buggy, like somebody was whipping a horse, like a little snap of the whip. So that wasn't happening.
Not that I'm aware of.
You weren't in a horse and buggy.
No, you must have gone backwards in time somehow.
Maybe I did. I went backwards in time. I'm very anachronistic that way. I like the Amish. They're very pure people. You know, being an anachronism, kind of a joke, so to speak. I was trying to make light of something. Oh, you do? Well, that's good. All right, did I? In terms of this, the QCV trust that's in the courtroom, people just need to forget about that because the issue of presenting the UCC is enough of a technicality. So when people bring this up, they're trying to be bedazzlingly brilliant in reference to all this. I realize it's a case. It does exist, just like secured party creditor exists too. But if you look at the documents, if you review some of these documents, you're going to see it's all tied up with establishmentarianism that combines church and state, and they have all sorts of biblical references. And that doesn't work because we're in disestablishmentarianism, the separation of church and state, and have been for a long time. So when people bring biblical references, it's sort of a laugher in the courtroom. Nobody really gives it credence, or at the same time, SPC has those references. Let's put it this way. It's on paper, but it's not orally dissertated because it's not important and nobody really wants to hear it, basically. It's like if you're a cocktail party or a party in general, whatever they call it nowadays, it shows my age when I say cocktail party, I guess. I don't care. But, you know, you have, I call it cocktail idle chatter. If somebody brings up the religious aspects and starts bantering on about the Bible, usually people are repulsed by it and kind of run away, you know, in the other direction. So it's the same way of discussing an insurance man and religion at a party. That would be the same thing in terms of orally discussing these religious aspects of contract law. I mean, it's just ridiculous, and I don't want to hear it, and most people don't want to hear it, because I'm a disestablishmentarianist, so I separate those two because it's too complex to bother with that whole thing, especially since my opinion that the Bible is just a poetic book and it's a poetry. I know that the religionists would be very against me on that whole thing, but so be it. I really think that scriptural writing is mostly poetry. It's like a song to the whoever their God is, basically. I'm a theist. I don't mean to condemn the God issue, but I'm just saying, in politics, it's not a place for that. It really isn't. You need to stay with the legal issues or whatever the legal provisions are, and then I adhere to the trust provisions of the pure trust, which have no references to any type of religious scripture at all. It doesn't have it. It's a legal jargon or lawful jargon. I should say lawful jargon. In terms of pure politics, and that therefore, when people start babbling on about biblical references, my opinion is we got 2 feet, walk away, because it really has no place. And India has been failing recently. They in the past couple of decades and or more, they've been since Home Rule of 1949. So it's been quite a while, I should say. It's 66 years away out of you, 67 years, they've been attempting to put establishmentarianism, and it doesn't work. You know, they try to put karma in the law and reincarnation. It's a complete and utter failure, and people are always saying why, and I say it's too complex. You're dealing with things of supernatural or not of the empirical world. It's just not there. It's a spiritual thing. It doesn't impinge, in my opinion, in the physical reality. So I'm not condemning either one, frankly. I'm just trying to have some clarity in, with all these references. I think the clarity is important, to be clear on what have you, to take one thing at a time or one aspect instead of convoluting it, twisting it all up and putting it in one inextricable thing. Because the spiritual world, in my opinion, and the physical world are two separate domains. So how are you going to combine the two? Do you agree with me on that? I don't mean to imply that. What is your opinion about establishmentarianism?
I'm absolutely in favor of separation of church and state. I don't believe they should be mixed at all. Yeah.
Right.
I mean,
you agree with...
it doesn't make sense because not everybody's of the same, even though they might be theists, even though the majority of people might be theists, they're not all of the same particular religion or spiritual path. And so I think it's forcing something on people, and people should be able to have their own beliefs. And it doesn't matter. It has nothing to do with governing whatsoever. You know, those are people's individual beliefs.
So do you believe that specifics of a physical domain are separate from a spiritual domain?
Yes.
Okay. See, now that's where I believe the separation comes from, because they're two separate places when you get in reality. And most people in the physical domain, if they're religionists, they might believe in heaven and all that business. But in physical reality, when you get right down to it, they would agree that physicality is not heaven, correct? So then why are you trying to combine heaven and earth, really, or the physical area? So that of itself, that simple theory or idea shows right away that how can you put those together? You see what I mean? To me, it's a separatist idea. But I know in religion sometimes they have this business about the wrath of God coming down to physical plane, the angels and all this business, and some kind of reference with physical bodies. And in terms of the spiritual view, I don't agree with that. I think, again, we need to attend to our physical politics or society without that reference. Now, if you're a religionist, don't they go to church on Sundays and all this business, or they do some form of worship, but it's not really involving your daily physical life? Like, for instance, I know some people do a church on Sunday business, and then during the week they do their work, their labor work, correct? And then during their workday world, I know that the ministers and what have you are trying to get people to be involved with these things during their physical lifetime during the week. But they never do that. I mean, they just go about their labor and then they go to church on Sunday. So in one sense of the word, that's all separate in terms of that. But I've heard, because, you know, I was raised in religion, and they always were trying to get people during the week to live by spiritual things and all that stuff. I mean, I understand the concept of that, but I say it doesn't work in terms of putting it all together and trying to merge it all together, because it's a different place. I mean, really a different location. I mean, even a religionist would claim that heaven and hell are different, or heaven and physical life is, because we know when you die, you're not, if there is such a thing as soul that is eternal, is separate from the physical body. So to be meliminous about this, or laborious is the word for it, it is pretty much a simplicity in terms of what I'm trying to portray in the separatist idea with this. I don't think it's that complex, do you?
No, not at all.
But they make it a big deal. See, there are a lot of these Bible thumpers and people at the podium that are try to combine the two, and I don't see the rationale with it at all. I don't see it at all, other than to cause a bunch of trouble. You see what I mean? Or they're pushing some religion, per se. What I do on this show is to try to give knowledge and information to bring clarity to the law issues, what's in the courtroom, what's the international law. I don't get into spiritual ideas. I talk about health. I talk about my raw veganism and things of that nature. But I still think that's separate from spiritual life. See, so to me, it's very important to be a disestablishmentarianist. I mean, people don't have to do it, but I'm trying to show the rationale for that particular and very specific information that I think is too general and people don't really understand it. So I think I've done a service tonight, and I would recommend any people that are on the show, new people and journeymen, to review this information tonight, to repeat it and play back the archive tape to really comprehend what I'm talking about here in terms of separation, in terms of the disestablishmentarianism. And anti-disestablishmentarianism is the same thing as establishmentarianism, but they just prefixed to disestablishmentarianism when that came after establishmentarianism. So you probably need to repeat that or play it back to get what I'm talking about there. So in other words, establishmentarianism and anti-disestablishmentarianism are the same thing. They're both combining church and state. And therefore, disestablishmentarianism is to disassociate church and state and to break up that establishmentarianism in terms of combining the two, which to me doesn't work. It doesn't work, and most intelligent people, most educated people would agree with that. Not to say that people are ignorant of this, but they need the specific information. They are ignorant in terms of they ignore information like I'm giving, or some people would give this rationale in the past. I don't know if they have in terms of the detail that I've gone through this evening. I think it's important. And we got off into that, but I wasn't really bringing that up necessarily as a topic, but I was starting out tonight talking about the Sestipulae Act of 1666 and sort of merged into that whole thing. Because, see, they get into a lot of establishmentarianism too, and these decrees by the government, they're convoluted in establishmentarianism, have no basis in practicality because the government is not supposed to be making declarations or affidavits unless they're tied to a pure trust. Essentially, they are, but in terms of any type of these decrees, they can be trumped by Uniform Commercial Code Notice of Dishonor, and that's why that's allowed, because it's a remedy for any type of challenges to the sovereign. In other words, the government shouldn't be making declarations and affidavit, albeit because pure trust does run the present the azimuthal equidistant projection of the earth area, the declarations and affidavit are really tied to pure trust, but the remedy still lies in the sovereign being able to trump it with UCC 3-503, which is a notice of dishonor. Okay, they are in an honorable position to do that, but when they challenge the enacted sovereign, the sovereign that's aware of it has remedy in law. You see what I mean? It's just like money transactions on a daily basis can be challenged because they're in breach of contract. And we're not liable for limited liabilities of compelled benefit in old 1-207 of UCC, which is now the amendment is 1-308. But the old language of 1-207, which still prevails, is sort of shrouded in 1-308, is we're not liable for the compelled benefits. We can utilize them, but we can challenge them as well. In other words, we can use the tool, but we can also put it in the toolbox. You know, we can use it or not use it at our choice in terms of the sovereignty. All right, so we're getting down to the last few seconds. I thought that was a nice, lively conversation today. What did you think, Gabriella?
Yes, it was very enjoyable. Thank you. I agree.
You're welcome. And I want to thank you for being here each week. I really appreciate you, your participation and feedback. I do appreciate that quite a lot.
Well, you're quite welcome. Do what I can. I'm not necessarily like you are, but I hope I'm helpful.
Yes, very much so. I appreciate it. And I want to thank the journeymen that come each week and listen in, and also the new people. We do that especially for you because this may be brand new, and we have probably 500 shows in the archive, so you're most welcome to listen to that at your leisure at any time. So I appreciate, again, your participation and being here and listening to the information. And I'm Grantham Taylor Hughes for my show. I have to wind this down now, and I did really well with that by saying winding down. Have a great week, and goodbye for now. So you can get me for my and a panda at the very end in terms of like, I went, and have a great week, panda, and a panda, Jack and Anda. So you can yell at me. Go ahead, yell at me for my bad coordinated defense. Go ahead. I'm entitled to it.
No, it's okay.
I want to be yelled at for using Anda.
You only did it like once, so.
And a panda, Jack and Anda. Tastes like sugar canda.
Mm-hmm.
I should make a rhyme with that. Coordinating conjunction and a panda, Jack and Anda, tastes like sugar canda. Don't ever actually do it, and then you won't Anda, panda.
So I'm going to make a couple of
like that?
Yeah.
I thought it was a lively conversation.
This was a very lively conversation.
Lively. Well, I really want, and I'm glad I brought out this anti-disestablishmentarianism thing, really focused on it tonight. And it was in my whiny mode, too, so I was digesting my food.
Well, I think it's important. You know,
Always
trying to insert.
But that whole Sesugavay trust has all sorts of biblical reference to it, and so does SPC. It's just total wackadoodle stuff. They claim separation of church and state, so all their documents show all this crap.
Mm-hmm.
It's all that Christianity crap that's behind things. Just
no,
pure rubbish.
It's just like the President of the United States has this war on the Bible. That's crap.
Yeah, and then Alcoholics Anonymous, a Christian, 12 steps, all Christianity.
But that's not government, so they can do that.
Well, sure, it's tied to, what do you mean it's not government? Private organizations, you mean?
Yeah, it's a private organization. It's not a government.
NGO, non-governmental organization.
What?
NGOs like United Nations. United Nations is a government. That's what you're loving.
I'm talking about Alcoholics Anonymous.
But that's an NGO, non-governmental organization.
But it's not.
It's an NGO, non-governmental.
NGO. Yeah, but I understand.
I mean, in technical terms, an NGO is not. It's an organization that's not a government. But it's in religion. It's tied to religion. The 12 steps are all religious. But it's tied to that. It's all religious stuff. See? And so that's what I mean. That the undertow of religion is always involved with it. Well, but it doesn't need to be. I just said it on the show. Repeat it and listen. It doesn't need to be in there because it needs to be separated. It's just rubbish. So I think I'm really a great proponent of disestablishmentarianism. So that means I diss things. Okay.
If we're leaving it at 2:45 tomorrow,
yes,
then probably we should leave the 11:30 to go run.
I see.
Because we have to be back by 1:30 in order to leave by 2:45.
I get that.
Okay, because we're going to stop at Whole Foods on the way there to pick up microgreens.
Mm-hmm.
Because on the way back, listen to me and pay attention.
It's hard for me when I'm molested.
On the way back, I don't know. To walk off, okay?
I didn't walk
on the way back. We might not be coming back to Route 70. It depends if these people place orders. These people that want to collect cash place orders, I've got to go by and pick up the cash. And
how do you know? I thought they're
already. I'm calling one tonight and the other one I'm going to start to talk to in the morning.
Oh, they're actually going to place the order?
I don't know. I don't know yet.
Why did you say they're going to put it?
One has to talk to the husband. And the other one.
Why do they have to do it in cash? What's their buzz on that?
Because they're non-American born. One's Chinese, they always do everything in cash. And the other is Greek. And her husband's in the food business. And they and
where do they get all this cash all the time?
What these Europeans and these Chinese and Asians do, they deal in cash.
Where do they get the cash from the bank?
Well, in restaurant business, they get paid in cash.
They do? I thought they use
checks, I mean,
well,
credit cards.
They get paid a lot of it in cash, and they deal in the food distributorship. And it's a great food distributorship. You know, they all deal in cash, a lot of cash. I don't care, you know, I'll go and shoot up the cash. They don't want to pay in check.
I see, I got a tree. Sure you want to have a weenie?
I have to do this, you know? Do you ever pay me?
I'm sorry, you have to get upset. Stop being upset.